Now, the way in which we listen to music has dramatically changed over the last, 20, 30 years. The days of hanging around the radio wishing for your favourite song to be played, long gone. All the world's music is now at the touch of a button. And with over 615 million users, Spotify, for most people, is the go-to place for all your listening needs. All you want to hear and lots more besides. But how exactly does Spotify know what we want to listen to? Well, one man who knows this area inside out is Glenn MacDonald. He's a data alchemist and he's just written a book about the subject titled You Have Not Yet Heard Your Favourite Song. And Glenn worked in Spotify. He just left the organisation in 2023 and he's on the line now from America. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
You're coming in loudly and clearly from your basement.
I'm coming to you from Boston, where we do not know how to pronounce the word Celtic, but I hope you won't hold that against us.
You say Celtic. Well, you know, that's fine. You're evangelistic about the power of music to unify. That's a good place to start, isn't it?
Yes.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty of Spotify.
I do. I believe music and food are the two things that break through our fears of the other most effectively.
So if we listen to other people's music or if we eat their food, that creates a connection.
At least it helps overcome the idea that they're strange in ways that you can't possibly fathom.
Yeah. Tell us a bit about yourself. So you play a bit of music.
Oh, I do, but I'm pretty bad at it.
Okay. And then you went into software by accident or design?
It's sort of both. Like everything is sort of both, I think. You design things, but then you fall into them. I started doing tech support when I first got out of college. And I really think everybody who works in technology should have to spend a year doing tech support to sort of develop empathy for how people experience technology before they begin foisting it on them later.
That's a good one. That's a good one, yeah. Do you not just turn it off and turn it back on again, Glenn? Is that not the answer to most things?
Well, you can try that first, but yeah. I mean, the thing that I learned from tech support was by the time most people ask for help with a problem, they've gotten several steps into trying to fix it themselves. Hmm. And so the problem they've ended up with is not probably the problem they started with. And software design is all like that. It's all a process of trying to work back to what is the human problem that you had to begin with. And music is like this too. Like, what is it you were originally trying to do? Yeah. You were trying to find a song. You're trying to learn something new. You're trying to calm down or get excited. Like, what was your original goal?
You have a lovely history of music, I suppose. Let's do it that way. And then we'll get to the streaming. So I suppose there was sheet music and then there was vinyl. And that brought us a good way up to about, 30 years ago, 35 years ago. Then came the CD and then came the people who copied CDs and created files out of them. Take it from there.
Yeah, so we had a peak of the music industry, what we can now look back and recognize as a peak with CDs, which was in part a little bit artificial because it had a lot of people purchasing again things that they already had on cassette or LP before. And then Napster destroyed the world, basically. And Apple came along with a download store and didn't quite save it. And then streaming came along and the overall graph of the industry starts going back up pretty nicely with streaming. And it's not yet in absolute terms, like the US industry is back above its CD peak. But if you adjust for inflation, as you should, it's not quite there. But we're not as many years into the streaming rise as it took CDs to get to the peak. So it's sort of reasonable to imagine that streaming might get us back to the size of a music industry that we had with CDs.
That's interesting. And we'll come back to that statistic. So what are we talking? Is it around 14 billion? Is that it in American money? $14 billion.
It's several billion. Yeah. I just look at the peaks, not the numbers.
Okay.
It's hard to hard to make any sense of the numbers that large.
Now, will you talk us about streaming, because I was just talking to my wife about this. She says, what book are you reading? So I was explaining the book. And at the moment, she has Billie Eilish's album on loop. And she said something lovely. She said, I still can't get over the fact that I didn't have to pay for it. And I said, well, you sort of do, because we have a subscription to Spotify, but you can get Spotify free and you can listen to Billie Eilish's album on loop. So will you talk us through the thinking there, that who at what stage did people decide that some people were going to be able to get their music free, and a lot of it at that?
Well, I think this was the great premise of subscriptions and even ad supported, where you're not paying directly, but you're paying by listening to ads. Yeah. So the advertisers are paying for you. And the contention that went into this to begin with, which is why the major labels bought into it, is that each individual person will be spending less money than the heaviest spenders spent in the CD era, but the average will be much higher. Uh-huh. So it's sort of hard to get really good data about what spending was like in, say, 1984. But most estimates I've seen say that the average music buyer in the 80s spent somewhere between $25 and $60 in the US per year. Okay. And with streaming, those people are now spending $120 or $140 a year. So that is a pretty big leap. And there were some people, like, I spent thousands of dollars a year myself at the peak of my CD buying, and now I'm spending the same $120 or whatever as everybody else. So a little of it cancels out, but there were so many more people that spent nothing on music and just listened to the radio in the old days, or would buy one or two CDs a year. So the premise is get everybody spending a little more, and hopefully that will be better.
So people like you, you're getting real benefits, aren't you, from streaming?
Oh, totally.
Yes.
But, you know, I also go to concerts and I buy T-shirts. So my money still goes, okay, not as much money as I spent on CDs when that was the only way I could discover music. But there's still other money going into the music business and reaching artists that, other than just my subscription.
Now, the book is fascinating reading. You've not yet heard your favorite song, How Streaming Changes Music. But you have to remember that a lot of people, when you mention computers, just the word computers, they shut down. So when we're talking about, like, what happens in Spotify, let's keep it vernacular, if you don't mind.
Sure, sure.
Okay. So the aim of an organization like Spotify is to make money. So it's profit,
yes,
right? We'll take that as a given.
Yes, it is a capitalist.
Yes.
Publicly traded company, yes.
So, but the service they provide and the job that you do in analyzing this mountain, this ginormous mountain of data,
yeah,
and trying to improve the experience that people have on Spotify, using algorithms and maths and all that sort of thing. Try and give us that in a sort of a pub version.
Sure. So I had the privilege of not having to work towards profitability on a day-to-day basis. Right. Like, that wasn't my mission. My mission was figure out what we could do with all this data. And so the main thing that I found that we could do is basically collate collective knowledge. Like, when you as a listener listen to music, you don't do it randomly. You don't just listen to random songs from the universe. You have tastes and you listen to things that you like. And in doing so, you're forming knowledge. Like, you're expressing your taste and your expertise and what you know about music. And when you put 600 million people's listening together, yeah, that is a lot of knowledge.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
And so the things that I did with computers and math, and the math was, I mean, if you're afraid of math, you're afraid of math, but it wasn't very complicated math, just like dividing things by other things, was to try to find those patterns. What do people share? What is different about people's listening in Dublin versus Jakarta? What's different about the fans of this band? And what does that tell us about what other bands might be similar based on what kind of audience they share.
And the end goal then was to deliver back to us things that, when I say Spotify, it's really the computer algorithms thought we would like. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, the algorithms don't think, really. And they don't have opinions, and they don't have emotions, and they don't really understand this idea of liking. And this can be a problem, because the fact that you listen to something a lot is a good sign that you probably like it, mm-hmm. but not always. Sometimes it's something you just left on in the background and you forgot about. So the goal is really finding patterns, not attaching. The emotions and the words we attach to them are human acts. So saying this is a recommendation, that's a human attaching a supposed meaning to a pattern that the math finds.
Glenn, I'm intrigued by this because as a consumer of music since a very young age, I don't really want music to be recommended to me, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, why did Spotify think that that was something that people wanted?
Well, so, you know, Spotify's motivation is to keep people listening and thus keep them subscribing.
Yes.
And most people spend most of their time listening to the things that they mostly like. So if you can give them sort of an endless stream of basically the kind of thing they like,
yeah,
then the inertia to keep listening is very high. So that's sort of the most motivation for a streaming service.
You know, a lot of people listening, everyone has a story of where Spotify suggested stuff to them and it embarrassed them. You know, they were in the middle of a dinner or a family party, and they put it on whatever random select, and they play something, and they go, that's embarrassing. I would never play that to anybody. But that's so algorithms make mistakes because that's the nature of it. So talk to me then about money, because that's important, because we established earlier on that the revenue from streaming is nearly back to the peak of CDs, although it's getting there, okay?
Yeah.
And
yet
we're constantly hearing musicians give out about Spotify, saying that it's next to impossible to make a living out of music anymore. So where is all the money going, and why can't people make a living?
Well, it's actually more of it is going towards artists now than used to be. The amount of, in the CD age, the like supply chain and the CD stores and everything took somewhere around 45-50% of the money. And the streaming services pretty much all have the same deal. They all take about 30%. And I think in the iTunes download era, it was like 35%. So the amount of overhead going to the like delivery system is actually lower now than it's ever been.
So the delivery system is Spotify.
Right.
Yeah.
But Apple Music and Amazon Music, they all have basically the same
deal. And Tidal,
30% of revenue. Yeah. Right. So if you're an independent artist, then in percentage terms, good news. Like about 70% of what people spend in your direction makes it to you. If you're on a label, then you have a much more complicated contractual situation to deal with, where probably you got an advance, and the deals are structured so that in theory you earn that advance. That advance is sort of a loan, and you earn it. You don't have to repay it, but you earn it back with royalties, and you often don't. Like most artists don't.
Yeah.
They're given more money to make their record than they actually later earn.
But say I played Declan O'Rourke now, who's an Irish singer-songwriter. I just played him on the radio there. He will get money from that. When I play him through Spotify, does he get a set amount for each play?
It you could sort of think about it as yes, but technically no.
Okay. Well, you have to explain that.
The way it works is all the money, there's a system called pro rata. It's Latin. But what it means is all the money that is paid to Spotify gets put into a big pool. And then all the streams people play get accounted for. And the money gets divided up according to your share of streams. In practice, it gets more complicated. And there's a whole chapter in the book about this because it's really done by product and by region. So like the premium subscribers in Ireland are one pool, and the free users in Canada are another pool.
But, uh-huh.
basically,
so it's a different rate in each region and each subscription model. So
it varies very slightly. It varies quite a bit across regions. So Iceland versus India, the prices of streaming services are very different in those places. And the amount of average activity is pretty different too. So the rates are fairly different. So you as an artist, if you have a global audience and you get a royalty statement, you'll see that you get a wide range of rates and they can change month by month as well.
Okay. It still doesn't answer the question, if there's so much money around, why are people giving out?
Yeah. So there's two factors, I think, there. And the most obvious one is there are a lot more artists. Uh-huh. Now. Like
there's 10 million on Spotify.
Yeah. And that sounds a little worse than it is, because I'm an artist on Spotify and my lifetime earnings are creeping towards the $5 mark. I think I might get there eventually, but I am not trying to make a living.
Yes, you're a hobbyist.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of those 10 million people know that they are hobbyists like me and are not aiming to it. But the interesting difference is in 1984, if you were not on a major label, you were not going to get played on the radio. You were not going to have your records in large chain record stores. Basically, you knew you were never going to become famous. Mm. On a streaming service, like my songs, they're the same number of clicks away as Billie Eilish's songs. So I could imagine, and there's no technical hurdle to this, that tomorrow I could become huge. Like tomorrow I could get a billion streams. It's not going to happen.
No.
But there's no technical reason why it couldn't. Like I could not sell a million records in 1984 because they weren't there. They weren't in the store. Nobody could buy them. So the number of, although those 10 million are mostly statistically people who know they're not going to be stars, a lot more of them can dream.
Yeah, because it's cheaper to make music and they don't have to go through the hoops and jump the hurdles of an A&R man and all that sort of thing. They can do it from their bedroom and they can get it easily enough put up on Spotify. What was Taylor Swift's beef with Spotify? She's coming to Dublin this weekend for 3 gigs. 150,000 fans will be singing along to all her songs over the weekend.
Oh, so this was years ago, but she felt that streaming was still in an experimental stage and she didn't want to be experimented on. And the thing I always say about this is if you are the artist that people who buy one album a year will buy an album from, you can do anything you want. So she had all the power. Like her fans were going to do whatever she needed them to do. If she told them like her new album was going to come out on Edison wax cylinders and they all had to go to antique stores and buy wax cylinder players, they would do it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The biases, and it's a fascinating book. I'd say it again, because the built-in biases of what has happened before Spotify, the algorithm sort of perpetuate those. And there's a great example of Reba McEntire, famous country and western singer, putting in country women or whatever, country music, and she had to wait 153 songs before a female artist came up, and you explained that, which is brilliant. Maybe I'm wrong here on Spotify, but this phrase is bandied about a lot, surveillance capital, where people are taking our information and using it to profit from it. Is that a thing with Spotify?
Well, I mean, technically, sure, because they're definitely profiting from being able to personalize your experience. So, I mean, a streaming service.
They're providing a service. You know, there's a quid pro quo, isn't there?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so thinking of Spotify as surveillance capitalism, it's technically accurate, but so is like your credit card. Your credit card company knows everything you buy with your credit card because that's how it works.
But I think when I hear that phrase, though, it's sort of used in a derogatory way. So people like in Meta, formerly Facebook, that they take it and sell on our details, and then people advertise to us, you know, and they're making huge profit at our expense.
And I think there are two levels of fear with Facebook that don't yet apply to music services, and one is that they have a lot more data about you, and the streaming service really doesn't have much. It knows what you listen to. It knows what country you signed up in. It knows what age you said you were.
Because you had to give those details. So they know I'm male, 59, I like Bill Withers, and I'm living in Dublin. Okay.
Right, but they don't know, like, if you started to buy underwear online.
No,
like, all
they don't know
Facebook
any of that.
Facebook knows about you. They don't know that stuff.
I don't think, no, once I bought, yeah, I bought some Calvin Klein jocks online. If I can't get my music on vinyl, CD or cassette, I ain't interested. No Spotify for me, I'm proud to say. Word of mouth is far more powerful. That's Anthony. The music industry fleeced us for years. I remember buying CDs for £20. I have CDs at home with £24.99 on them. And that's when it was pounds and it was a lot more than dollars. I'm happy to pay for Spotify, says Jared in Cork. My complaint about Spotify is that it only sends me stuff I've heard before. It rarely suggests something I've not heard before. That's David in Maynooth. So, but I'm a bit like you. I think it's phenomenal because I was making playlists on cassettes back in the 80s, and now I can do it at the touch of a button, and the sound quality is great, and I can jiggle them around, and it'll shuffle play back to me. And now with Shuffle Plus, it'll put in extra songs if I want them or if I don't, and it's all good. What's the future, Glenn, do you think?
Well, I think the thing to me that the industry has not really done is appreciate the extent to which music is a communal experience. Like, we form communities, we listen to music to talk about it with our friends, to find other people, to find other artists. And the streaming services experience so far has been very individual. Like, we talk about personalization, but we don't talk about community forming. And so that's the direction.
What would
that
look like? Because can't you do something now where you can be listening to the same thing at the same time with somebody? They have that.
Yeah, so you
could
do a little bit of interpersonal sharing. You can make playlists, and those playlists can start getting an audience. But there are not a lot of tools to show those communities to themselves and build them, let artists form communities to. It's kind of being done using the existing tools because that's what people do, but the platforms aren't really invested in supporting and nurturing those communities. Okay. So that seems to me like the next step.
And you're gone since 2023. So you were there for the big money for Joe Rogan, for his podcast. What was the chatter in Spotify when that was announced?
You can readily imagine what it was. And for me as a music person, I just want, if I ran the company, I'd be like, we are a music service. Our goal is to get songs to listeners and listeners to artists and make money for artists and to keep music going.
Okay.
So podcasts, I helped a little with some podcast recommendation things because the techniques are sort of the same. But to me, it was always a distraction driven by business imperatives, but not like Joe Rogan doesn't help me discover music.
So finally, we're starting at the beginning, if you like, the title of the book. You have not yet heard your favorite song.
I think curiosity is super powerful. And I was an album listener, and I grew up as a kid listening to Rush and Boston and Black Sabbath records. Pouring over the. I just eventually discovered Clannad and Cactus World News. So, I mean, I have some Intuit Nua.
Clannad, Cactus World News, fair enough. Yeah, Intuit Nua. Yeah,
okay. Right, okay. So I know where I am.
Yes, you do. Fair enough. Yeah.
But for me, the wonder of being able to listen to stuff, find stuff all around the world that I would never have encountered before is immense. And that openness is critical. If I just sat still and waited for Spotify to bring me the rest of the world, it would never happen. But it's that faith that there are things out there that I really will love if I can just find them that drives me, that keeps me going.
Final texter, I've no problem paying for Spotify, but the cost of live concerts completely kills any community vibe, says that person. One of the tickets for Taylor Swift's concert here was €735. Like, it's just astronomical. But the fans love her, and there's no doubt about that. Glenn MacDonald, thank you so much. You have not yet heard your favourite song, How Streaming Changes Music, a former Spotify data alchemist, Glenn MacDonald. It's a really interesting read. Thanks, Glenn. Thank you so much.
Go find your favourite song now.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.